This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Call it the new normal, or use an older term, hard times. Either way, millions of Americans are hurting, and they're worried about their future. 14 million people are unemployed. Millions more realizing that the jobs and the income and the home values that they once had may never come back. From young people entering the workforce all the way to retirees leaving it, there is anxiety and frustration. We've been reporting on these stories for months and years now, but in November, we're going to take the story out on the road. Veteran correspondents Debbie Elliott, based in Alabama, and Richard Gonzalez of our San Francisco Bureau will spend the month reporting from places we don't often visit, and they'll be telling stories from people we don't often hear from. And we're going to ask for your help. Debbie and Richard have been doing some traveling already, and they join us now. Debbie, Richard, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So what's the idea behind this project? I mean, is this getting behind all those poll numbers we hear?
You know, it'll be an opportunity to do that. We're going into an election year. It's 1 year away. What are people thinking about? How are they living? How are they coping? What is it like for everyday people in small towns and communities across America? What are they thinking about when they are looking to next year's election? What are the issues that are important to them? How are they surviving in this economy? You know, you hear a lot about people thinking that the middle class is somehow being squeezed out. Well, let's go find out what it is people think and how it is they're living.
The other thing, you know, we want to be listening for are people's hopes and aspirations. What gets them out of bed in the morning, even when we're in such tough times, and when perhaps they, their friends and family might be really struggling? You know, do people feel alone? Is there a sense of commonality about these struggles? And where do people draw their strength from? Those are some of the basic questions I hope to ask and find answers to.
So, Richard, where are you planning to start this trip, and what exactly are you hoping to find?
Well, I'm starting the trip kind of close to home, looking at what's going on in the Silicon Valley, where the economy is still very strong, and hope to talk with some people who have a ground zero kind of orientation to what's going on there. And then to the north of where I live, there's Solano County, which is just the complete opposite of the Silicon Valley. It's a county in a crisis over foreclosures. It has the second highest rate of foreclosures in the country.
Wow.
And so I attended a town hall meeting. I heard people talk not only about foreclosures, but also their anxiety over the shortage of good-paying jobs. On that theme, I want to play this tape cut of a man named Robert Frazier, who told the town hall meeting about an invention he hopes to manufacture and market.
Imagine a sleeping bag. Now imagine that sleeping bag attaching to the top mattress like a fitted sheet. Walmart loved it. So when they say we like it, we put it in our store. I went off to try to get manufacturing. I have the patent, so I'm legal, I'm ready to roll, but I can't find no one to manufacture it for me unless I go to China or India.
And needless to say, Robert Frazier hopes to manufacture his product here in the United States, where he can create jobs, he hopes, for Americans.
And that's interesting because there's so many things wrapped up in there, the manufacturing, the innovation, and all those things kind of being stifled in this economy.
Absolutely.
Debbie, where are you headed?
I started my trip in Meridian, Mississippi, and I spent a little time with a family there, Norris and Janice Galatas. Norris is 49 years old, but he finds himself now in early retirement from the Army because of injuries he suffered in Iraq. Now this family is trying to live on less than half of his salary. They're really struggling to make ends meet, and they're disappointed because they feel like their interests are not being served in this political and economic climate that we're living through. Here's what Norris told me.
Politics and corporations have run our country into the ground. It's sad that the American dream is not even realistic anymore.
You know, the couple never thought that they would find themselves in this position at middle age. They thought this is where things were supposed to start to get a little bit easier for us. You know, we'd almost have the house paid off. We'd be waiting for that gold watch, as Nora said. And they say that's just not possible anymore.
Now, we're hearing clips from interviews that you've done, but we should say that you're using suggestions from NPR listeners to plan out the rest of your trip.
Right. I'm actually going to head to Huntsville, Alabama next week for my reporting. And that's because a listener, Erica Mossholder, replied to our online call out for story ideas. And she started telling us about how Huntsville is going through a tough time right now because of the decline of the aerospace industry. You know, that city has been a mecca for engineers and been a bright spot in Alabama's economy for a long time because of NASA's space shuttle program. Now, with the end of that, there are all these rocket scientists and the like who are underemployed. They're out there looking for jobs. They are not the jobs there that there used to be. They're having to leave town. And then all of the engineers that are coming out of the college there are finding that they're not able to find work. So we're going to go find out what's going on in Huntsville.
Yeah, Richard, can people still get involved at this point? Or, I mean, how else can they contact us?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're looking for help and suggestions and tips through Facebook, Twitter, the website, email. So far, we've had a tremendous response, close to 1,000 responses from almost all the states in the union. And we're always open to more ideas.
NPR's Debbie Elliott and Richard Gonzalez, their month-long series of reports, Hard Times, A Journey Across America, begins November 1st. You can follow our Hard Times series on Twitter at NPR Hard Times and at NPR.org, where you can also help us plan the trip. You guys, best of luck.
Thanks, Audie.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Congressional Supercommittee has less than a month to reach a deal on deficit reduction. And so the race is on, not only for lawmakers, but also for hundreds of special interests that want to influence the outcome. This week, the committee held a rare public hearing. And as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, it was an opportunity to see lots of lobbyists at work.
Most lobbying, like much of the work of the Supercommittee, happens out of public view. That is, unless there's a hearing.
All right, folks, quick reminder before you go in. No food, no drinks, no
flowers. Lobbyists line up for a chance to sit in the hearing room, to take in the atmospherics, and maybe grab a few words with a staffer along the way.
I like, you know, being up here. Sometimes just good to, you know, be seen, wave the flag, pick up tidbits.
Joel Packer is executive director of the Committee for Education Funding, and he's a registered lobbyist. He represents 90 different education groups, urging the supercommittee to avoid cuts to education.
A, they, you know, theoretically have jurisdiction over everything. B, they've revealed nothing of what they're doing.
He got in line an hour and a half before the hearing started. The queue wraps around the corner and down a long hallway in the Hart Senate office building. In all, 619 different groups and corporations said they intend to lobby around the work of the supercommittee. All of them mentioned the supercommittee or the legislation that created it in their mandatory third quarter lobbying disclosure forms. They range from the Air Transport Association to Walmart, the American Hospital Association, Halliburton, General Motors, and General Electric. The list goes on and on and on. Bill Allison is editorial director at the Sunlight Foundation, a group that pushes for transparency in government.
Anytime you have something that may be a really fundamental change, it is going to be a magnet for lobbyists, and it's going to draw them like honey draws flies.
Because whether the committee does something or nothing, a whole lot of bottom lines are going to be affected. And that keeps the lobbying business humming.
They're not really there looking out for the whole country by any means. They're looking out for this narrow interest. And the problem is they end up controlling the debate.
For people whose job it is to see their group's interests reflected in legislation, the supercommittee presents some unique challenges. If the committee fails to come up with a plan, it means automatic cuts. If it does agree on a plan, it skips the normal process and goes straight to an up or down vote in the House or Senate. David Certner is the legislative policy director for AARP, and this seems to make him nervous.
These, you know, special, fast-track, non-amendable rules apply to them, and there will be no, basically, debate in Congress with any opportunity to amend any of the changes that come out from this group of 12.
In addition to direct lobbying, AARP has a television ad in heavy rotation that's targeted at the supercommittee process.
We are 50 million seniors who earned our benefits, and you will be hearing from us today and on Election Day.
The message, in short, is please don't mess with Social Security. And if you have to make cuts from Medicare and Medicaid, bring down health care costs. Don't make seniors pay more. The next day, in another hallway, Mary Kingston is just coming out of a meeting with a staffer in Supercommittee Javier Becerra's office.
At least they have this information that now they can bring it to their boss. We can't do that.
Kingston is a lobbyist for the National Association of Secondary School Principals, which is part of Packer's Education Coalition. Last week, the group sent a 13-page letter to supercommittee members outlining what would be hurt if education funding is cut. Now Kingston says they're going to every single office to follow up.
We did hear from a few offices saying, oh, we already got the letter, we don't need to meet with you. But we pushed back and said, no, we feel so strongly about this that we really do want to come in and tell you personally and highlight some things.
A few minutes after she leaves, another group of people in dark suits heads into the office, no doubt hoping to personally highlight some other things. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Even with unemployment at just over 9%, some jobs go unfilled. And that includes tens of thousands of jobs that pay middle-class wages. Many require little more than a high school diploma and a month or so of training. But it turns out that not everybody wants to be a long-haul truck driver. People are reluctant, even though demand for truck drivers is rising fast. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
The story really begins 3 years ago when freight traffic fell off a cliff, pulling down with it tens of thousands of truck drivers. But now at the American Central Transport Terminal in Kansas City, Chad Still is showing off a lot of empty concrete.
Not a lot going on over here today, which in the trucking industry, that's a great deal. The less trucks and trailers you see around here means the better the freight is.
Freight is moving at pre-recession levels, and companies are hiring.
Stay true to blue.
Call Conway today at 866-WORK-4US, 866-WORK-4US, or visit con-way.com.
Analyst Noel Perry figures trucking companies are short about 125,000 drivers. So what's the holdup?
It's real simple. Let's say you get laid off tomorrow. Do you have a commercial driver's license? No.
For that, you'd have to spend 5 or 6 weeks and a few thousand dollars at an institution like this one. The Fort Scott Community College Truck Driving School in Kansas City, Kansas, where students like Corey Dockery come to restart their careers.
I looked on the internet, and that's all you really basically seen were driving jobs and, I guess, working in the healthcare field, and I really didn't want to be a nurse.
But mastering an 18-wheeler is not as easy as it looks.
It's a 25-mile-an-hour ramp, and we want to be down into sixth gear for whenever we make the turn.
Today, John Williams, a second-generation trucker, is coaching Dockery and another student through traffic out on I-70.
We're going into the ramp. Slow down just a little bit.
Corey Dockery is just focused on mastering all the shifting and tricky backing maneuvers. Landing a job is the least of his worries.
I never thought in my wildest mind that I would ever be a truck driver, you know, but the way times is changing now, it's like you have to find something that's going to be steady and permanent.
Permanent, maybe not. A lot of people who go into trucking seem to be in a hurry to get out of it.
Trucking is an industry that goes through people like oats go through a horse. It's a tough job.
Todd Spencer ought to know. He used to be a trucker, still looks like one. Now he's executive vice president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association. He says this driver shortage is a myth.
It's not a shortage. The problem is retention, and you won't be able to keep good people if you don't pay them comparatively for the demands that you ask.
Long-haul truckers can pull down more than $50,000 before expenses, but it can be a pretty brutal job. Truckers routinely drive for weeks on end without ever going home. They work and live in a cab about the size of a large office cubicle, eating in truck stops and sleeping in the parking lots. They're paid not for their time, but for the miles they drive. They see family only when work permits. And Bob Costello with the American Trucking Association says the work is getting less forgiving all the time.
If you're a new driver to this industry, you better be on your game every day, because once you get a record, you got in an accident, it was your fault, you're going to be fired, and it's going to be very difficult to find another job in the industry.
There's no escaping the scrutiny these days. The government now tracks each violation, from flat tires to fudged records, and scores each driver. That's new last year. Coming regulations will likely trim the maximum workday and force truckers with serious health problems to get off the road. All this is pushing some drivers out and making quality drivers more and more valuable. Bert Johnson with Conway Truckload says the industry is just starting to respond.
Pay's gone up a little bit, but really, in the grand scheme of things, we're paying people the same way we paid years ago. Now, that's going to change, though.
For the better, as far as drivers are concerned. Johnson says companies are also adding benefits like better health care and signing bonuses, even rejiggering logistics to get drivers home more often. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
Income gap is a central theme of the Occupy Wall Street protests, and if you attend just about any of them around the country, you might see a group of people who are often dressed in matching T-shirts. They typically seem older than your average protester, but no less enthusiastic. NPR's Jeff Brady reports that labor unions are now finding a place in the Occupy movement.
Here's a familiar scene. Noisy protesters angry at executives from big banks. The man behind the microphone blames the country's wealthiest 1% for keeping too much for themselves. But this is not an Occupy Wall Street protest. It's not even 2011. This is AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka at a Chicago rally 2 years ago. You could be forgiven for thinking the message sounds similar.
Similar. They're identical, essentially.
Damon Silvers is policy director and special counsel at the AFL-CIO.
As Occupy Wall Street gathered steam, it was sort of like, well, they're doing the same thing we were doing. We better be part of this.
And while unions complain the media ignore them, the Occupy Wall Street protesters are leading newscasts and showing up on front pages. The two sides didn't immediately warm up to each other, though. Cornell Labor Studies professor Richard Hurd says unions had to be sure the Occupy movement was here to stay and that it would remain nonviolent.
And the protesters certainly don't want the labor movement to come in and take over their movement because they feel that they own it, they started it, they created some energy around it.
This is what democracy looks like!
So far, the union seems satisfied just supporting protests like this one recently in Philadelphia. Paul Dannenfelser heads Local 1723 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
I think we know that this is a movement led by students, and we're not leading this movement as union people, but we're a part of it and want to be a part of it.
Downtown in front of Philadelphia's City Hall, there are several dozen tents set up. Protester Leela Wright says unions fit in well with the Occupy movement.
Like, if you really understand capitalism, you understand why we're out here. You know what I mean? And I feel like the 99% involves a lot of people, and that includes the unions.
Nearby at the information tent, Stanley Joseph says unions and protesters are helping each other.
I think we're bringing attention to them, and we're giving them a platform to make themselves heard. I think, in my opinion, that this is what the greatest purpose, one of the greatest purposes of Occupy, is to simply give people a platform to air their grievances.
But look around the Occupy Philadelphia site on a weekday afternoon, and the only sign of unions are actual signs. There are posters everywhere that read, "Workers' rights are human rights," but no union tent or other permanent presence. Marlene Bodner with the group Granny's Peace Brigade says if unions really supported protesters, they'd be here.
It would mean they'd have a table here, and they would be walking around and, just embedding themselves in this, and they're not.
Union leaders say they don't have the resources to staff a tent day and night, but they are opening union halls to protesters who need a place to take a shower, and they're providing legal help. Across the country, Occupy protests also have set up labor outreach committees to coordinate with unions. And when the next big protest happens, you can bet union members will be there. In fact, there's one planned at Temple University this afternoon. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
And you're listening to NPR News.